Yeah, but I mean, in conversation, you know, there's like facial expressions. People aren't just kind of staring blankly at you for 20 minutes at a time, you know, or like worse, just looking at their cell phones. But I have a laser pointer, and Zach Watson assured me that this is safe to shine right in your eyes if you're on your phone, so. But I was thinking about that, you know, why even extroverted people might not really like speaking up front. I mean, I think my heart rate right now is like 140, so. and I think a little bit of this is about developed social skills. I guess, sorry, we're already off track 30 seconds into this, but I have the microphone now, so you have to listen to the whole thing, so. Even extroverted people, is that gum? Okay, thank you. I'm just making sure my kids aren't putting gum on the pew. So, even extroverted people don't really like getting up front, and that's because, I mean, I've had hundreds of thousands, I guess, of conversations, social interactions where I can kind of like figure out what's going on, like, oh, you know, yeah, speak a little quieter, or change topic, or like totally abandon ship. But this is like a whole thing that I've never really practiced at all, so. Anyways, that's enough of that, I guess. Now we can get to the slides. This is the title slide. You can tell that because it's the first one, and the words are really big. So it says, How Pop Culture Sees Us. Culture being the combined customs, means of communication, language, art, achievements of a people, and pop refers to popular. Most of our culture has developed over hundreds of years, but some aspects are much more rapidly changing and shifting. Rapidly, at least considering, you know, hundreds of years. A big driver of this, at least in my lifetime, has been television and movies as a means of communications and ideas. There's major themes, minor themes, things that are being said if you pay attention to the deeper message. I said, maybe hidden, but usually people that write this sort of stuff are pretty smart, and it's a message that's there on purpose. You don't really have to be involved or invested for this to affect you. It's so ubiquitous. Reports say that the adult in the average American household watches 3 hours of TV a day. I was actually the writer David Foster Wallace once quipped, I don't really understand how that can be. I don't think that I know anybody who watches 3 hours of TV a day, but I guess the only place I've ever seen the average American household is on TV. So culture surrounds us, and I say us because people here probably identify with Christian culture, whatever that means exactly. It has its own centuries-long arc, its own rapidly shifting aspects, but it's a place we're more familiar with, more comfortable with. Christian culture, though, has its interface with pop culture, perhaps next to or somehow nestled around this. And surely we as individuals have our interactions, and we have to make decisions about how much we'll interact. Let's see if this clicker works. Pew! Yes. There's a popular way that this is phrased as a youth. I was instructed to be in the world, but not of the world. What a great phrase. Has anyone else ever heard this? Yes, okay, yeah, good. Otherwise, the next few paragraphs are going to be pretty lame. But the problem is, that's a man-made phrase. It's not really in the Bible. Jesus used some of the same almost words a few times in John chapters 15 and 17. But the ultimate point that Jesus had might be a little bit different. Here's Jesus. Whoop. It was working. Here we go. So here's Jesus in or just before the Garden of Gethsemane. Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't have their version of what happens exactly in John 17. Their Gospels focus more on the Last Supper, Peter's emphatic pledge to never deny Christ, Jesus' plea with the Father about his coming struggle, and then Jesus' arrest. John has most of these events as well, but he pulls a little switcheroo. Instead of recording Jesus' prayer of anguish, he records in chapters 15 through 17 some sharing time with the disciples. Jesus' prayer in John 17 seems to happen with all the disciples present. But to summarize chapter 15 in the book of John, Jesus says to stay connected with him. There's some talk about vines and branches, things that we're all familiar with, that we've all heard before. And the second part of that chapter, he points out that if people are mad at him, hate him, mistreat him, crucify him, then his followers probably shouldn't expect much of a get-out-of-jail-free card. Then someone, a big defender maybe, of that phrase, in the world but not of the world, will jump right over to John 17, which is all one prayer by Jesus. He's pleading for vindication and the restoration of the correct power structure of the entire universe. These two chapters have lots of the bits and pieces of the phrasing that people have used to say, in the world but not of the world. But unfortunately, I think that often boils down to a fairly exclusionary sentiment. I'm so glad I'm not like these other people. Who does that sound like to you? And I would say, cuidado. This is now a bilingual sermon, so if there's anyone that was not happy, if there's anybody Jesus was not happy with, yeah, it was the Pharisees. And you want to be pretty careful not to sound like a Pharisee when you're talking. A brief story. Once upon a time, I lived in the Avenues. Pretty nice neighborhood, kind of. It's nice. There's nice houses. There's some sidewalks. It's nice if you want to like kind of walk around. But any night that you don't remember to lock your car, some meth heads will rummage through your car. So maybe it's actually not that nice of a neighborhood. But it was pretty annoying. One time, they would take like your change. One time they took three or four of my favorite CDs, which I was upset about because it's hard to replace CDs. Music stores kind of went away with Blockbuster. You know, you're not going to find CDs anymore. Anyways, that's where I lived. But I needed to move to the house where I now live in Mill Creek. Have you ever felt like you have more stuff than when you have to put it all in boxes? Moving is an instant existential crisis. How can I have this much stuff? Where did it come from? Why do I have it? What on earth am I doing? I'm just going to burn it all and start over. In truth, though, at the time, we, meaning Catherine and I, didn't have too much stuff. But the important part of this is the moving crisis. Another part of the moving crisis, you do not want to undershoot moving. You start thinking of, like, how many linear feet of a truck am I going to need? You know, is one 18-wheeler going to be enough? you get just real paranoid, like, it's a whole thing. But everybody knows. Unless you can still move in your car, which is sometimes pretty beneficial. But anyways, part of my solution was to ask every single person I knew to help me move. So at the time, I was in a residency program at the University of Utah. I asked those people. I asked people at church. Katie asked people at school. And then one Sunday morning, probably 30 people showed up at my house and packed up our 15-foot Penske rental truck in like sub 40 minutes. Around the 45-minute mark, one of my friends from the family medicine department came rolling up, clearly not a very good friend, you know, did not come at the time appointed for moving. And she was just amazed. They had recently moved, and it took them like all day long. And by the time she showed up 45 minutes later, there was nothing left to do. And she said, "Boy, where'd all these people come from?" And we said, "Well, a lot of these are our friends from church." And she said, "I guess I need to go to church." And that is what John 17 is about. Yeah, you could highlight some phrases from John 17. The people of this world hate them because they don't belong to this world. Or you could instead decide to highlight, I'm sending them into the world. I am not praying for these followers. I am praying for everyone. I want all of them to be with each other. I am one with them and they are one with me. This world's people will know that you sent me, that you love. The entire chapter seems to be much more about drawing people into God's love than being proud about being different. And I think this is important to keep in mind when considering our interface of cultures. There's always a decision and a spectrum at the interface of two ideologies. How much will we isolate? How much will we integrate? This is not unique at all to Christianity. It happens often in religion. Buddhist monks on mountainsides dwelling in clouds, Hindu mystics covered in ash on the banks of a polluted river. This is a decision for extreme isolation. It's also possible to become lost in extreme integration as well. Pictured here is the Hillsong United Pastoral Staff to the Stars, Carl Lentz, disgraced and dismissed after a bunch of classic problems. He was in the tabloid news for partying and drinking with Justin Bieber. So each of us has to decide where we're going to exist on this spectrum. I'm worried that Seventh-day Adventists have pushed this a little too far to one side. I mean, it's human nature to cluster around our core identities. It feels safe and easy to be around familiar people. But at this point, we've created a substitute, almost parallel world. There are some places here in America, education, kindergarten through college, graduate schools, healthcare, bookstores, TV channels. You could go your entire life and have 90% of your interactions be only with other Seventh-day Adventists. And I don't think it matters how you interpret John 15 or 17. Surely that's not the goal. It's okay to be exposed to ideas you don't agree with. There are things to learn. It says here, pregnant pause. So. This is a bad show. How do I know it's a bad show? Easy, I was not allowed to watch it when I was a kid. Perhaps just existing in the world has made you aware that this is the TV show, The Simpsons. You may also know that the show was created by Matt Groening. And given the general state of media, culture, and Hollywood, you might guess that Mr. Groening does not consider himself a Christian. A few other facts about The Simpsons you may not know. This is the longest-running TV animated comedy. There's always so many qualifications. But anyways, of all time, with 34 seasons. Debuting in the year 1989, and it's still going, although it's really kind of on its last legs now. So this was a big show in the 90s when I was like 10 and 12 and 14. And at that time, I used to get a magazine about youth Christian culture. You know, they tried to make it really cool. But anyways, in the magazine, they had an advice column. And there was someone else who was clearly in the same boat as me. They wrote in asking, it was like letters to the editor about the morality of the show and if and why it was a bad show. The editor's reply started with some pretty low-hanging fruit, pointing out how Bart Simpson was disrespectful to elders, Homer Simpson had a drinking problem, or the fact that throughout the show, disputes are often settled with violence. But the part that surprised me was the editor's ending. He pointed out that despite the show's flaws, there was a character, Ned Flanders, who was very interesting. He never curses. He is slow to anger. He is patient. He is an involved father to his children. In fact, he is a single father taking care of his children. The editor concluded with the message that surely the show's creators, despite their professed atheistic views, must have had at some point a positive experience with Christians. So positive, in fact, that despite losing their faith in God, they didn't lose the expectation that those who follow God would be great neighbors. Galatians speaks about being a good neighbor. In Galatians 5:14, Paul repeats the lesson given by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus originally said, treat others as you want them to treat you, but Paul changed this slightly. To love others as much as you love yourself. He wrote about this again in the next chapter. You obey the law of Christ when you offer each other a helping hand. It's a message that people resonate with, respond to. It's what people expect from Christians. After all, it is in our Bible. I think it's pretty reasonable for people to expect us to live up to the standards that we set for ourselves. It's so crucial as well because so much of our day-to-day interactions with others is what takes up our time. To borrow from, and maybe, I don't say heavily, and paraphrase, Canadian psychologist and pop culture lightning rod, Jordan Peterson, your life is not the moments captured in the picture on your desk at work from your Hawaiian vacation. It's how your spouse greets you when you come home every day. It's how you speak to each other over meals at the dining table. These are not little things. They are a large portion of every day, and therefore they are who you really are. To adjust this to church, we are not an evangelistic seminar. We are how each of us chooses to interact with our neighbors every day. And this can be very hard, at least in the way that I think Christ meant it. Appearing kind, caring, and compassionate to the people we want to, when we want to, is easy. Luke 11:13 points out that anyone can do that. Even us, sinners as we are, can be nice to our own kids. But you know what is difficult? Loving others who disagree with you. And that phrase, I think, is trite and stupid even. Love others who disagree with you. That places the problem on everyone else. They're the ones who are disagreeing with me. It's their problem. What you really have to learn to do is love others when you don't agree with what they do. In popular culture, it's okay to hate and despise people who disagree with you. May I remind you of that John chapter 15, which we didn't read too much out of, but if you go back and look, you'll see that the world and despising is a theme that comes up a few times in that chapter. And I don't think I need to present any specific examples to get some agreement about pop culture being willing to hate people that disagree with them. But that's where Christians should be different. How should we treat our neighbors, people who vote differently than you, view gender identity differently than you do, crank up music you didn't really want to listen to, light their cigarettes and let the smoke float across their yard into your open window? The idea of loving others who disagree with you puts the impetus on them, but that's not the way it goes. It is you that needs to show them the same level of love that you would show yourself. How to do that exactly, I think, is too big of a topic for today. It's a very, very daunting task, but I think there is a place to start. When Paul wrote to the church in Thessalonica, which is a really wild word, a tongue twister maybe even, his recommendation to them about living their life was to try and live quietly, work hard, earn the respect of those around you. These are the starting instructions for loving your neighbor. Nothing too flashy. It's nothing fancy. You don't have to stand up on any stage and crank your heart rate up to 140 to do that. I had several other contemporary pop culture references, or examples, I should say, from movies and TV, acknowledging that other people can see the hope that is unique to Christianity. That other people recognize the inherent value in living things if we accept the premise of divine creation. But I didn't really want to get into all that. Suffice to say, it exists in pop culture. Because of your lives, because of the way you live, people notice. And if we can figure out how to really live up to the instructions of Jesus, to love not just our own little subculture, not just the people that we agree with, who knows? Maybe you will make a lifelong impression on your neighbors and end up as a cartoon character. And now I'm supposed to have benediction. So let's all bow our heads. Lord, please help us to be able to maintain our focus on sharing your love. And also I'd like to say thank you so much for this great blustery fall weather. Amen.